the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
This is a Sunday Morning Linux Review. This is episode 241. Just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
That's right. And you just heard just the two of us because that's all that's in the studio this morning. Our compatriots, we're sure that they're engaged in something very important.
Yeah.
And we miss them, but
we miss them.
Tom and I are going to carry on as admirably, I'll say.
Yes.
As we typically do.
So
this is, well, I think you already know. This is Mary Tomich.
And this is Tom Lawrence. And we are without Phil Parada and Tony Bemis.
That's right.
Phil was on call, and maybe Tony was too. Both of them. Yeah, both of them have jobs that occasionally pulled them away from things.
Mm-hmm.
Phil has like long, they pick who's for the type of work he does. He pick who's on call for the weekend. So I know he said he was on call, and if something occurs that he has to deal with, well, he's dealing with it right now.
That's right. So Tom, you and I'll carry on, and
yep.
I guess it's been a great summer.
Yes.
And I know in the last episode, I was just chatting with you before we started recording a little bit. I think in our last one of our recent episodes, we talked a little bit about SyncThing.
Yeah, SyncThing.
And because I was looking to get rid of Dropbox and come up with some other solution for my backup and syncing and that type of thing. So what I did, after we discussed it, I went a few days later, I went and installed it, or at least I thought I did. My system said it was installed. However, according to what I read, it's supposed to create a folder and it in the home directory, or it's supposed to create some kind of a directory someplace, which it did not do. And then when I went to you go to localhost, and I can't remember the port number that you use, but anyway, I went and
8443.
Yeah, exactly. What you just said.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I went to that. I took it out of the directions. It's been a couple weeks since I tried it, but anyway. So I went to that port on localhost, and nothing at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So then I thought, well, maybe the install went awry, and I went in and tried to reinstall, and it said, oh, it's already installed. So it's almost as if the underlying files are in place so that Synaptic knows it's installed and tells me so.
Well, did you kick it off and run it, though?
I did, I think. Well,
you have to. It runs from the command line, which is confusing, and it doesn't auto-start. And I'm sorry, it is 8384.
Okay.
I looked it up
real
quick.
I was thinking 8384. That, but I wanted to be polite and not tell you. No.
Yeah. Well, you're never as wrong as when you're wrong on the internet, so I thought I should correct that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, being wrong these days is hazardous.
It's hazardous. Anyways, that being said, you do have to actually run it. So you install it, and then you have to kick it off from the command line, and you can kick it off to run in the background if you want.
I'm wondering if that was my – I don't know why I missed that, because I went through the directions.
It's one of those things, and you know what? There's this guy.
I did RT.
Tom Lawrence, and he
RT
made this YouTube video
FM.
And how to set it up. I actually have a YouTube video on this.
I did listen to at least part of it, and then I thought, oh, I got this.
One of the things
Apparently,
one of the things I recommend in my video is using, and I'm a big fan of this. Even though I've got it running on my servers, and I've got processes set up for that, so they start. But run SyncThing GTK. It's really nice. It's a GTK front end for SyncThing, and it's officially endorsed, so to speak, by the SyncThing team. They don't develop it. It's third-party developed, but it works really, really well.
And I'm sure I already have all the GTK libraries installed on my KDE system.
So. Yep. It works perfectly fine in KDE. And with SyncThing GTK is it creates a really nice front end for it, and it has the options like, would you like this to start at boot? Would you like this to start on, startup of the system or only when you start GTK? And it separates, there's the GTK portion and the daemon portion. It'll even do all the auto update implementations
for
you.
Apparently, I must have only completed phase one.
Yeah. But once you have it installed, go ahead and load there's a PPA for SyncThing GTA. Once you load that, you're good.
I can't believe I missed that, though, because
I did
go
too.
To the site.
Part of the catalyst for the video was less about people. A lot of my inspiration for videos, people ask me questions about things. I spent a lot of time beating my head against the wall with SyncThing, going, what am I missing? And I kind of did the same thing. And once I figured it all out, and I'm like, you know, I better make a video of this for a couple of reasons. One, once I set something up, I may not touch it for a little while because it's working so well. And I want to have a tutorial on how to set it up. So
yeah, so it's as much for yourself as it is for others.
Yeah. Or even some of my videos are made for my employees too, because they want to know how to do a thing. And I'm like, well, they all need to know how to do this thing. So we'll do a video tutorial on how something works.
Yeah.
It's it has value. You know, I don't know if I mentioned this. I was going to bring it up to Tony. I published the entire video, and I haven't posted it on the SMLR site, but maybe I will, of how we do all of our editing now. Because I do the editing different than when I took it over from Tony. I have a different editing process. So I documented the entire Linux podcast editing for ours. And it's all open source knowledge. I mean, I show everything but our passwords. So.
All right. Well, yeah, that would be good too. All right. Well, then I vow to watch the second half of your video. And I'll report back then to let you know how successful I was. So that was one thing I did between the last time we recorded. And now the other thing, too, is I noticed that I run KDE Neon, which I love, love, love. But anyway, I noticed that the system seemed to be very slow and kind of sloggy. And I wasn't really doing anything intensive, like editing or rendering videos or anything like that, that would make it that way. So I went in and I took a look at what processes were running. And for some reason, I was running a bunch of Apache. I mean, I was running Apache as root. And then I had three other instances of Apache running under www-data, I think it was. And so I was trying to figure out, what am I using here that requires Apache server to be running? And I just thought, nothing. So I just killed it. Didn't do anything, but it certainly freed up.
Now you're running this as KDE Neon?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's odd.
I thought it was very odd. And
you've been compromised.
Oh, gosh.
Someone installed Apache and was serving up all your data.
Yeah, probably.
They have our show notes before they're published.
Well, that was good. but anyway, so I don't know. So that was kind of another little thing I was grappling with, trying to figure out, okay, well, why is Apache running on this system? Because I don't have, I just don't have anything running that would require it at that point. I'm not testing any sites or doing anything like that.
That is odd.
It was odd. So, but it shut down, and then a couple hours later, I went and looked, and it was still down. So
strange.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep an eye on it. Not going to say I'm going to uninstall Apache, because I have a feeling I might need it for some things, but not for day-to-day operations. So
I've done a lot with KDE Neon.
Have you?
I run it on my laptop, on my desktop. I'm really happy with it. And I've done two video reviews of it. So I did the first video review, which is like an overall review, but then I did a follow-up one just about the Dolphin File Manager, how the networking works, and the customization, like all the eye candy. And, you know, there's always someone poo-pooing it. Someone's like, oh, wobbly windows are stupid. I'm like, yes, I have no justifiable reason to turn that on, but I think they look cool. I couldn't rationally argue with anyone who said that's a dumb idea, but I'm like, I have them on. I like them. I like the little extra eye candy at the desktop level. It's one of those design things. Even though we spend so much time in the command line doing Linux things, there's something about all those little extra graphical things that make me happy.
And to an extent, I agree. I think it comes in handy if you got somebody who's got Windows 10 next to you and you're trying to
you want
to
show off.
Yeah. Exactly. Because Windows, as I've said before, and I don't want to continue to beat down Windows. I do. No, just kidding.
Yeah.
But I'm always taken back by the lack of flexibility as far as how I want my desktop to look. And that's why, I know people kind of, some people don't like KDE because it's bloated. And they've got a point. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Well, they actually don't anymore. Since Plasma 5, something I found interesting is, and we had talked about this several episodes ago, is the memory usage for the different distros. And it's really impressive how low Plasmas. I mean, it's really not. Once you get into 5, it's not very resource intensive. So the argument that it's bloated is actually going away because they've done such a great job with efficient coding on it.
That's good.
So it's impressive. So
I'm going to cross that off then.
Yeah, oddly enough.
Yeah. So, and the only other thing I did in the intervening weeks is I made reservations. I'm going back to Iceland.
Oh, awesome.
September, so, yeah, I should try to seek out a See if there's a Linux user group or BSD user group.
That would be kind of cool.
It would be cool.
What do they think of Linux in Iceland? There we go. That's...
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really a lot of fun. I mean, you know, we talked with Phil last
We're going to get him to do a Japan
Linux
episode.
Japan, and then we're going to talk with him. Yeah, and he can, I think, and he said he was planning to do another episode or at least a fresh looks as far as Japan and all of his activity. But anyway, yeah, so that's something I took care of. Got my Iceland fix taken care of. So anyway, but what about you? So
besides my trying to get some exercise and bike riding and things like that, I've been working on building some new servers with Proxmox and learning all about that. Mm-hmm. When we get to the Distro Fever, they've got a new version. That's on a little list of things to talk about. It's because virtualization is so popular and it's getting to be even a bigger deal. And mm-hmm. what's happening is it's just so efficient to run all these different virtual servers, and it's more secure from a structural standpoint to have everything kind of isolated and virtualized. Mm-hmm. Proxmox supports full pass-through, and that's what I'm trying to make sure I grasp really well, because I'm going to do some very detailed videos on it. And what full pass-through is, and some of the new CPUs have even better support for this, is you can take devices on the motherboard. And for example, we're going to take the controller card. So instead of having a separate box that runs FreeNAS and a separate box that runs our servers, mm-hmm. we have, if everything works right, Proxmox will run FreeNAS, and we can pass through a controller card directly that controls a group of hard drives, so FreeNAS can run simultaneously with the other servers. So it's...
Oh, that's sweet.
It's cool. It's complicated. It's awesome. It's open source. And so that's going to be a fun project. Other projects have been me doing the more videos, like I said, about the KD Neon, and mm-hmm. I'm really happy with it. Some people say, oh, it's a little quirky or this.
Maybe a little.
And
bit.
I do point out, like, if I switch themes back and forth, sometimes the theme doesn't apply until I log out and log back in. I'm not that worried about that, though. Like, I don't switch themes around. Once you set mm-hmm. them, no big deal. I logged out, logged in. What happens is the menu became the same color. The text was the same color as the menu. And I got it to do it during the video, like how it shows where the theme switches, but not 100%.
Okay.
So, but all that's, right. Yeah. How often do you switch themes? So...
Not that much anymore. I think, you know, when you first start doing something, it's so new to you and you're checking stuff out and all that.
You play with them and then you find the one that makes you happy and you're like, done. This is the one I'm using.
Yeah.
So.
But speaking of desktop environments, there, and actually this would not fall into that category exactly, but it's more of a kind of a window manager, tiling window manager. It's JWS. I was looking at that. It's kind of the base graphic interface for some lightweight... and I say that in the most positive of ways, Linux distro, just one of those lighter ones. And I was looking at it and I thought, man, this is a nice looking one, because you get the tiling aspect that I think a lot of sysadmins like when they want to mm-hmm. monitor many different things, but it's also pleasing to the eye, which is big for me.
Yeah.
And by the way, there is a message that has just come through from elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
And there was an alarm issue with Mr. Bemis.
Okay. It wasn't an alarming issue. It was probably the alarm didn't wake him up, maybe, issue?
I believe that's how I would define it. And then there was the question, are you still there?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, recording without you.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't show up.
Yeah, poor Tony.
Well, he can still stop by.
And then I laughed, yeah. We can certainly do that. But talking about window managers, that one was really kind of nice. And I think I may just give that a try on some of my older systems, because I've got an old 32-bit. Well, it was my workstation before I got that Zyreason one that I got back mm-hmm. in, was it 2016, I think. And it's, you know, it's 32-bit, so it's old. But I have a brand new motherboard that I got because I thought the motherboard was a problem with something, and it turned out to be memory. If I had only run memtest first, I would have bought the motherboard. So it's got a new motherboard. It's got its original motherboard plus this replacement, and then I've got two hard drives in it. And I was thinking of selling it, and then I thought, you know, I'm just going to repurpose this as some nice little system, and maybe even turn it into a headless server.
Yeah, there's I kind of like some of the lightweight stuff, and I also, to kind of further that comment, I do notice someone in a forum, I posted my KD review, and then on Reddit, someone's like, oh, no, you should, they don't like all the way the dialogue menus work, because they like the way you can customize, I think it's the Flux interface.
Okay.
You can
Fluxbox?
Yeah, Fluxbox. Yep. You can jump in and edit the files raw and start making contextual suggestions in there. So you can say, you can basically, it's like a regex filter where you can say, when this application is open, customize it this way and things like that. They're like, KDE is killing it because I can't get in there and adjust things as easily because of all the dialog boxes. So there's always someone who wants to customize it, but that is kind of the joy of Linux, of we can have these debates and we can still run the same software.
Yeah, it's great. And that just goes to show you the power of choice, as we said numerous times. So
yeah.
All right. Do we have anything else that
I think that's it.
I mean, you talked about your open
house.
Right?
Well, now it's in past tense. We had a grand opening. We with our new office, invited everyone over and all that fun stuff. So that we're all good with that. So that went really well. We had so many people here. So
I was impressed with the window coverings you've got on your windows, because when I saw the first pictures and I thought, wow. They got that little square, so that's how people can look out.
Yeah.
But then I think you had subsequent, either you mentioned it or there was a subsequent picture. You can see out without any real issues.
And specifically what Mary's referring to is we have a lot
of... Thanks for elaborating.
Yeah. We have a lot of... our whole front of our store is like a standard storefront with all glass windows, and we have those window graphics that put on. And they look solid... From the outside, you cannot see in the building anymore at all. But when you're standing inside the building, and specifically our tech area, you see out as if you're looking through tinted glass. And it's kind of – it's a really neat effect because people think we just can't see them.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So I didn't know this because this is the first – you know, we've only been here, what, 4 months now in this building. We're close enough to the water here that we have mayflies. And type in Michigan mayflies for those of you outside of our area. And, yeah, Mary's like, they're messy. They're a bug that once a year comes out, and every couple years they come out in absolute mass quantities. And these things just stick to everything. There's little bugs that only live for about 48 hours and die. And we've had some incidents in Michigan where people have had to get snow shovels. And in 2010, we had to use snow plows, down in where we border some of the Great Lakes just to get them off the road.
You know, I've seen them in Minnesota, near the river.
Yeah, they're really crazy.
Yeah, they where I live, I don't see them at all, but they're very close to water.
Very close to water. They're an interesting bug.
Do you have them here?
Yeah, and we had them all over our windows.
Mostly at night, though, right? Isn't it in the evening?
Yep. Yeah. Well, then it wasn't enough. I won't be
doing any nighttime recording down here in the springtime. I hate bugs.
Yeah.
That's why I like going to Iceland. They don't have bugs.
They don't have bugs. That's cool.
So...
You know, I've heard there's a lot of big people in Iceland. Like they're home with all the strongman competitions. Like they're a lot of large, strong people there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mini documentary.
Vikings, they're called.
The Vikings. There's a mini documentary called Iceland, the Land of Giants, done by, I think it's Vice News or Vox. It's a great watch.
I'll have to check that out.
But they go into the gyms because the strongman competition, these guys have to make their own equipment because they don't make gym equipment that is big enough for these guys.
Wow.
And it was just kind of neat because they have all these strongman competitions, and in Iceland this is a really big thing there.
Mm-hmm.
And like they interview these guys, like this guy would be absolutely a giant here. He's picking up thousands of pounds at a time deadlifting, and he's like, oh, I work at a grocery store. He's just like and it's just the average person there is a lot bigger. Like in strength, like they're just there's a lot of strongmen there.
Well, something to do during those long Icelandic nights in the winter.
Long Icelandic nights, you lift weights.
Oh, goodness.
So,
All right.
We're going on to feedback.
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show@smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
I don't think we have any feedback. I mean, we have the one gentleman who...
the audio, there was that audio question, I think. There was some ongoing conversation about it.
Yeah, Phil apparently replied directly to him, and we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, some of them, he said the audio was better on some of the other ones, so that's wonderful to hear.
Good.
We did have Kevin, I guess it's feedback for some, I like what he wrote. For some unaccountable reason, I seem to be subscribed to Lawrence Systems channel on YouTube. Regards. That's all he says.
Friend of the show, Kevin.
Friend of
O'Brien.
The show, Kevin O'Brien. Thank you for subscribing. Phil did have a comment for him because Kevin has his own custom domain, and he says, hey, you should be using a Let's Encrypt certificate. Phil suggests that to everyone. He's a big fan of Let's Encrypt.
Yeah, that's just one of the helpful services we offer here at Sunday Morning Linux
Review.
We
will suggest that you encrypt all the things.
We make suggestions.
Yep. I guess this is kind of feedback. It says, are you planning on attending VBSDCon in Reston?
Oh, that was from Brad. Yep. Long-time friend of the show, Brad. Brad Alexander, yeah. Yes. And I think it's in September, and it's just it was intriguing to me, but I took a look at my schedule, and it is just before I leave for Iceland, so I just can't see myself. I'm going to be spending money doing that trip, and I'm not going to spend money on.
Right. And
Even though I'm a big BSD fan.
In our own discussion we had, and it's related to this, is the Ohio Linux Fest.
Their
Submit for Talks is coming.
Yep.
We're deciding if we're going to talk there. So there's still that conversation going on as well. Not really listener feedback, but it's kind of a con feedback of whether or not we'll be there. Tony's deciding if he'll submit a talk, but he's not here today to share with us if he's actually submitting a talk.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's, I believe, on their way in.
So. Oh, Tony's coming?
Yes.
Awesome.
So we'll mock him heavily when he walks in.
Yeah.
You don't have an alarm clock. We could just set it off when he walks in.
We can always pause the show and add him into the mic drops.
That'll be good. But anyway, the other I also had got some feedback from Julian Overall, I believe, in the episode where Phil was here and he had I'd gotten that little green tea Kit Kat from him.
Mm-hmm.
I had mentioned that in the episode as I was consuming it. It was pretty tasty. And Julian mentioned that the green tea, it's called matcha, which I've heard matcha, I think M-A-T-C-H-A or some similar spelling. Anyway, and that is that's a very good green tea, and I remember it from reading about it from the tea ceremonies in Japan. And it's like powdered. It's like a powdered type of tea, and they whisk it and they create kind of a frothy top on
neat.
It and stuff. Yeah. So
I want to go to Japan now.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So anyway, so he mentioned that. So thank you, Julian. And I didn't see any other feedback.
Yeah, I don't think you've seen anything else on that.
So okay, well, good.
So now we're moving on to
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
Distro Fever.
Yes.
So let's talk about
that. What
did
you think?
I'm going to jump right on Proxmox. I brought it up.
I think that makes a ton of sense.
So they released a new version on the 4th of July. That's exciting for us techie people.
Yeah.
So, like we said, Proxmox is a virtual environment. It is Debian-based commercial distribution for running containers and virtual appliances. The Proxmox company announced the release of a new version, which is based on the Debian 9 stretch. Debian. I'm gonna get around one of these days. Now, for those of you not familiar, one of the things that's exciting about this is you have a lot. Virtualization is all the rage. Of course, that's how a lot of these large data centers run. So this gets even more interesting. There's not a lot in the open source side of this, not to this level of this advance, because Proxmox supports some of the features that you find from VMware, like high availability. And I think, was it the ESX server.
Oh, ESX.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the things that they're boasting, and this has been around for a little while with ESX, is one, the virtualization pass-through. Mm-hmm. So you run it raw. It's a type 1 hypervisor, which means it runs directly on the hardware and then can compartmentalize pieces of the hardware to the virtual machines, which mm-hmm. is the pass-through feature. But the other thing it can do is you could take a cluster of servers and put them together, and the virtual machine can run between them, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So if one of the clusters goes down, your application does not. So the virtualization part doesn't know where it's running, and it also doesn't matter.
Okay.
So it's and they're offering some of those features with Proxmox, and that's really cool. It also, there's an interesting idea I have that I want to try, which is some of the gaming features of it. Because you can put in video cards and pass through the video card processing power to the virtual machine.
Mm.
So you can run Linux as your primary OS. And this is something that I've seen a demo of in, oddly enough, I think it's the latest version of Fedora. And they're using hardware pass-through, so we can run it and then run Windows inside of Linux, but still have the full power to run some of the games. Because that's still a lot of the hang-up of so many people have, even myself. I have a Windows box at home because it's the only way I can play games. My kids like games. I like games occasionally, and they just don't – there's not Linux support for some of the top titles.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for people who have applications that only run on Windows and you need to use them, you just happen to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I fall in that category.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, on the weekends when I'm not using it and I'm back in Linux, it's just great. I just realized what a great.
I'm still, GIMP is on my to-do list, and that's still my biggest reason I open up a virtual machine is I like Photoshop. It's just so quick and easy. For doing things. I just gotta, the way it handles text is the thing. GIMP just doesn't seem to handle text the same way. And that's what I'm doing. I'm editing titles all the time for my YouTube videos.
Oh, sure. Or creating memes.
Creating memes. I can create memes in GIMP, but I'm not much more advanced than that. But like all the graphics for the Windows, we designed.
When's the last time you used the text feature in GIMP?
It's been a little while. So that's partly my fault, too, is I haven't really researched it. But when all the graphics that you see on the Windows and everything was designed in Photoshop. But the other handy part of that is we actually sent the Photoshop people to the graphics company. So we sent all the Photoshop files directly.
Okay.
If I send a GIMP file, I don't know how well it exports into another format because they're using Photoshop on their end. So when we do
I see what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
So there's that compatibility. When we redid our business cards, same thing, Photoshop. And we actually upload the Photoshop file to where we get our business cards from because that way they get it exactly right, including transparencies and everything else. They need that advanced file, like how you said there's a hole in the window for the way the cutout is. That's a transparency. So are all the little slots in the window. We designed it with the entire window and then measured. So won't go too far now. Back to Distro Fever before we get off on a tangent.
Just kidding.
The Shark Linux project has a new version. I think we did a distro review of that.
A long time ago. You know, with the appropriate jokes and everything. Mm-hmm. The one that kind of caught my eye was, and this is where I got my window manager comments from, is 4M Linux. Now, people may be wondering what the 4M stands for. and I'm going to share it with you. It's maintenance because it's a System Rescue Live CD.
Oh.
Multimedia because you can play video DVDs apparently. Although I'm wondering if some of the newer ones you'd be able to do that in. It's a mini server using the initd daemon. And then the last one is mystery.
Mystery.
They said, meaning a collection of Linux games.
Oh.
Like, why did you include that? That's the mystery. No.
Yeah, that's it. You know what? I think games might be relevant. Here's the reason why. One of the things we're always doing is we're booting up to rescue Windows like all the time.
Yeah.
And for a litany of reasons. So we might look at this because a lot of times we're just using Ubuntu because it's convenient. But what we're doing is you have a Windows machine that's crashed, happens frequently. You boot it up on Linux. You copy all their files to our we have a data store in our network. And it takes sometimes 2 hours to copy all their files. So why not play some games?
That makes sense. Makes sense to me.
So I might actually give that a try. That's pretty cool.
About 4M Linux?
Yeah. Like I said, I like rescue distros. They make sense to me.
Yeah. It sounds kind of cool. So, and I was talking earlier about some old systems, and when you're trying to get, because a couple years ago I was trying to get a friend of mine to try Linux, and so she had this old laptop, so I was trying to put it on there, but the laptop was so old that it was almost a disservice to Linux to try to get it to run on the sink for her because it wasn't just performing very well. So we never really kind of got there from here, proverbially speaking.
Yeah.
But anyway, this one is kind of interesting.
It looks pretty cool.
Play around with it.
Linux Mint has a new version.
I saw that.
So Tony
will
be happy about
that.
18.2.
All you minties out there will like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know the BSD folks, the free BSD folks, are slowly rolling to toward their upcoming release. I think they had another development version. There's upgrade.
There's Linux FX, and they're running the newer Plasma desktop, so they have an updated release. I think there's going to be a lot of people jumping on this Plasma. It's stable, and I think you're going to see more distributions go. That Plasma desktop is, you know, got a great look and feel, very customizable, and the stability of it. You know, combining that with the Dolphin File Manager and the way it handles image viewing and some of the other things has been really slick. So one of the things I demoed in my my overview of KD Neon is when you use an SMB or SFTP share, I can still preview all the image thumbnails. So, for example, the use case for that for me is when we go to a website and we got to upload some new files or we want to look at existing graphics, I can SFTP into a running web server, you know, in my hosting environment and preview all the images as thumbnails and things like that and manipulate
that
files.
That is kind of nice.
It's a really neat feature.
Time saver.
It's a time saver, and it's something you just had to go, I think that's the right file, and you have to double click and run each one to go, okay, do I open each image and see if it's the right image? The fact that I can just do thumbnail previews is really kind of handy. I didn't realize how handy of a feature that turned out to be. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And just to go back to Linux FX, I took a look. I went up to their site because I just thought, well, FX, that can mean a number of different things. And they, well, they're out of Brazil, as the distro watch paragraph says. But apparently the company that supports them also does some security stuff.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure how integrated that is, but I just wanted to say it. And they also, there's something called, there's an office, WPS office. I don't know if that's the one out of China or not, but it is apparently supposed to be very compatible with Microsoft Office for people who need that type of thing.
Yeah, actually, their website is interesting. They have a bunch of facial recognition and digital.
Yeah, it's kind of security stuff. So I was trying to figure out if this is sort of the community edition of the software that they run. I didn't dig into it that deeply, but
you know, this is actually very interesting, and I'm looking at it later. They have some NVR type software on there. It's a camera OCR system, and that is something we have a demand for clients, and there's not a lot on there. To give you guys an idea what that's used, the use case for
OCR
that.
OCR is an optical character recognition.
And what they do, for example, one of our clients is a bridge. They own a bridge.
Okay.
And they track license plates.
Oh, sure.
And
there you go.
Yeah. A lot of government usage for it, but there's actually parking lot uses. That's how they know which ones are in the parking lot. And a lot of that's very proprietary. So the fact that they maybe it's something open source, so something to dig into.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they can count all the license plates and gather them all up so they know who was where in the parking lot. And they do it for billing purposes.
Because
you bill for it's a parking garage system. And it's really slick how it works, but that software is out. I mean, it's.
Well, what about that, those plate covers that if you shine a light on it, it diffuses it so you can't read the plate?
Yeah, they have a lot of those because those are used to thwart the traffic cams, which is the government use for them. But the parking garage companies use it so they don't have to put an RFID tag on everything. They can just sense your license plate and control the billing. Oh, you're in the parking garage for this long. You checked in here, checked out there. And they use it for security at companies to understand who's in the parking lots and when employees got to work and things like that. So they have some business case use for it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think it might be time to talk about
tech news and views.
So we do have some breaking news.
Live breaking news.
Live breaking news. We said just the two of us. And during that little news intro,
you hear
Tony
that third
came
voice?
Here.
That's right.
Hello.
So now we have Tony.
Yes, we have Tony.
So there's the first piece of the news.
And Tony is armed with news.
Tony's armed with news.
Yeah, I brought some.
And it's more than just the news that Tony's here.
Yeah, so... Anyway, so I don't know who wants to go first, but I've got a couple.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, one thing I was going to mention, and this was actually an Ars Technica, is that OneDrive has stopped working on non-NTFS drives. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is just goes to show how sometimes, I don't know why Microsoft made this decision, except that if you've got a little SD card and it's a FAT32, formatted as FAT32, then does that mean you're totally SOL, or you're going to have to do some kind of conversion in order to get it to and copy those files over onto an NTFS system and then integrate that with
the OneCloud,
which is
but they're also trying
their online drive.
Once people start storing, and this is a challenge for OneDrive that's been – it is kind of a challenge for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So if you have your desktop device and you're a graphics company or you're a larger company and you go, I have all the things on here and I have all the storage. I have 3 terabytes in my computers. So no problem. My laptop does not have 3 terabytes. It has a single SSD. And the concept is on your portable devices, you want to get those files on demand, but you want them in the list. So what they're doing is saving just the metadata so you can create a list of files. But then mm-hmm. when you double click it, it goes, oh, you want to download that one. And this is what OneDrive's been trying to accomplish. So you can somehow make it very fluid, go, oh, I just want that file. And it goes and pulls that file out of OneDrive and loads it locally. But you can't sync your entire database of files, you know, or just file list of files and contents because it would exceed the storage on your smaller portable device. So I think that's probably why they're using NTFS. Yeah. So they're probably storing some type of enhanced metadata in there to make it indexable. But I know one of the challenges, and this is kind of a funny one, the thumbnails were occupying all of the devices storage because some people with really large libraries of things, even using that just by loading up OneDrive and it would sync like their list of files, something in the storage of it would cause it to overflow the hard drive and you'd run out of room.
Wow, holy cow.
So they've been really trying to revamp how OneDrive works. Google's figured this out in a much more fluid fashion, and that's what they're trying to play catch up with.
Yeah. Mm.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Thanks.
Google's like, welcome to the game, guys.
Yeah. You know, and there was something on Fosforce this past week that kind of Fosforce, just to be clear, that kind of caught my eye. And the question was, and this was, I think, Rob Miller. He asked the question, should the FAIR license replace the GPL? And I thought to myself, well, I've never heard of the FAIR license. What the heck is it? So, of course, and since I'm doing this all on my phone, I can't even get to the definition out of Wiki. Well, here we go. So, I went up and looked at I looked it up where everybody goes to look stuff up when they've got a question, Wikipedia. And they said it's actually, and this is kind of surprising, it's a permissive free software license, which is compatible with the GNU General Public License, or the GPL. Its text, and I think they're referring to the FAIR license text, is composed of only one sentence.
Yes.
So that tells me it's even shorter than the BSD license.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a disclaimer, thus being the shortest license ever approved by the Open Source Initiative.
Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
Usage of the works is permitted to provided that this instrument is retained with the works, so that any entity uses the works is notified of this instrument. Disclaimer, the works are without warranty. And then at the top would be whatever your copyright information is. That's the entirety of the license.
Yeah. Wow.
It is really the TLDR of licenses.
Yeah.
But you don't, it's not like they summarize a license by making it a summary.
Yeah. Some people did then is they went and sought out some additional information as far as what does it mean? I'm sure lawyers were involved. But anyway, I'm just kidding to all my lawyer friends. But they said you can use the software for commercial purposes. You can also grant or extend a license to the software. You can distribute it the original or modify derivative works. You can modify the software and create derivatives. You can change the software's name, blah, blah, blah. You cannot place a warranty on the software license. So, and I think that's why you have to include that disclaimer of no warranty. And then you must include the full text of the license and modified software, which is pretty short, one sentence.
Yeah, so. It takes up, less than a kilobyte.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, the article goes on, though, to attempt to answer that question.
Yeah, I think it's funny that most licenses, limit it down to just a few sentences to explain what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, it takes a lot more than the actual license to explain.
Yeah, that's true. So, I think the article concludes by not really answering the question, but just kind of asking the user, what do they think? And I think corporations, if they can... I'm not going to use the word get away with, but if they can use software that's already been working, like open source software, they're going to use it. And some of them are really good about giving back. Some of them will, and Goldman Sachs, and I apologize, but Goldman Sachs always comes to mind where they had ripped out the GPL information and just went ahead and modified it. There was one of their Russian programmers, there was a whole lawsuit in New York about it, but I won't. We talked about that, I think, a couple years ago, so I'm not going to rehash that. But I just find this license kind of interesting, and the only worry I have is that there's a lot of effort that goes into creating different different software different open source software. And that effort is not, I mean, it's free and it's not free. It takes time.
I try to give back a lot myself. I donate to them. And
I probably
eventually I'm going to set up some recurring ones for different projects like the Caden Live. I use it so much and promote it a lot. I've donated several times to their code sprints and things like that. But, I mean, I could put that on recurring.
$5 a month?
Yeah. Hey, anything I can do to help them out, because I use the code. I'm certainly thrilled with it.
Yeah, so those that's really those just the news items I had kind of caught my eye. Just licenses, kind of something we all contend with.
Well, something you didn't bring up was, do you know what today is? Besides just the two of us, but three and
just
Sunday,
just the two of us plus one.
This is hashtag Day Against DRM.
July
9th.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I
one of the calls to action on this, and it's you can find it on Defective by Design, is
open up a Pirate Bay account.
Pirate Bay account. Of course, this is the EFF and a lot of other, all of our free software friends. This is supported by a lot of different participating organizations. And one of the things that I didn't really think about, but they make a really interesting point of Netflix. Netflix has always maintained that their DRM is integrated because that the studios wouldn't license the media to them without integrating a lot of DRM. Well, Netflix's most success has come from their own content, and they still contain DRM, and it's self-produced. There's no one told them to put a license in it. So, so there's a call going, why don't you take out the DRM for your own content? So,
yeah, that's an interesting question.
Related to this, I use Downpour is my book library, and I refuse to use the other services. And a lot of that's because, one, I'm a huge Cory Doctorow fan, and Cory Doctorow has always maintained the same thing. So there's the other book company, the one owned by Amazon, who can rename Nameless. I'm not going to plug them. Everyone knows who they are. But they integrate full DRM in all their stuff. So when Corey releases his books, they're always free. And he says they actually are bugging him because they know the popularity of his books. They're like, oh, put your books in there. He refuses even to let them have his books because unless they will release a DRM-free version. And he's done this with several other different publishing companies. Dealing with the Amazon is his biggest one because they're so huge. And he doesn't care. He's like, no, if you won't remove the DRM, you can't have my books. So he does release them on Downpour, and I don't mind buying them. I support Cory Doctorow. His books are wonderful, and the reason I use Downpour, they're the only, to my knowledge, maybe there's other ones out there, at least they're the only big one I'm aware of, but I subscribe to their service because they're all DRM free. So once you get a book, you own the book, which has been a problem. There's been times books have been recalled, and because of DRM, you only can use their software to play the books back. If they recall a book, you don't get to have the book.
I remember that happened a few years ago when I think when digital books or e-books or whatever were first coming out. Amazon,
they pulled books
they
and
pulled
they disappeared.
Something right off people.
Yeah,
and that really bothered a lot of people. But your mention of ownership and that type of thing. There was an article in, I can't remember the publication because I wasn't expecting you to talk about this, but the article discussed the fact that we're really shifting from an ownership society to a non-ownership society.
My kids don't have a concept of ownership like I did. I bought music. I owned a physical piece of media, and my children have no concept. We have a music subscription service, and they just listen to whatever they want whenever they want. And there's no concept that I own it. To them, they built a playlist of their favorite songs, so they have a series of playlists, but there's not any concept before where we had to make mixtapes. We put a lot of effort into that. And the mixtapes technically didn't even fall under fair use.
Right.
Because you're now duplicating media, and you're technically violating agreements just to do that, but there's no physical media. They don't own it, so they don't have a concept of that. Like, I had a movie collection 10 years ago. I don't anymore. I couldn't tell you last time I bought a movie, because I will admit, I am a subscriber to Netflix. It's convenient. Google Play.
If you want to see something, I guess you can go to Google Play.
Well, you can buy it through Google Play, but there's no physical library. And once again, it's locked up in the Google Cloud if I bought it. Google does a lot of promotions. They say, I've played games with the Google things. You can find promo codes, and I got movies on my Google Play. They have all these 99-cent offers. So I'm like, yeah, for a buck, I get to watch it anytime I want. And that I know of, they haven't pulled any. But, yeah, I used to have my DVD library. It's all gone now.
Right.
I kinda
same
like,
with us.
Yeah.
Since we moved into the house, the DVD library has stayed in the boxes in the basement.
Yeah.
Just because we have Netflix and Hulu and, you know.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
It is kind of interesting. And even extending that to automobiles.
Yes.
I really think that car companies, well, no doubt they're already looking at that.
Well, Zipcar is popular in Detroit. Yeah. And a lot of people who live downtown have a Zipcar subscription, which you can just use the car whenever you want. And you don't own a car. But then again, every time I have a problem, my car made a noise this morning that I know is going to cost money.
Money noise.
As you're older, it's like, that noise isn't interesting. That noise sounds expensive. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it shouldn't make that noise when I start it. So it's like, the concept of not owning the car and paying a fee and just always having one available is not – it is very hard for the older generation who are used to possessing things. But the other side of it is, I don't know, it didn't sound that bad. Because I would just get a different car that didn't make that noise and someone else's problem.
Yeah, and when I lived in New York City, I didn't even own a car.
Yeah, and in inner city
I rented one if I wanted one.
Yeah.
Which I never did because – either I was going with traveling with somebody else who had one, or
you took a
public
cab to
transportation
the airport.
Is so extensive there. It's amazing,
and it is nice. Non-existent here.
Right.
Well, so. I did ride that new Q line.
Well, yeah,
it was fun.
I rode it. I got off and I walked because I wanted to get somewhere.
No, it's a little longer than that. It goes from Midtown to downtown, and then I'm thinking they need to now extend it from Midtown up to 8 Mile.
Yeah, they really
to the
do.
State fairgrounds.
That's a whole other discussion.
And that's a local. Yeah, that's a local thing. Sorry, folks who
that's
are
right.
not local.
Yeah. It's our attempt here in the Motor City to have a public transportation system, and we could rant. We could do an episode if anyone cared about ranting about public transportation in Detroit. It's
we have a train that goes in circles, and then we have another one that goes 2 miles.
Yeah, it goes 2 miles, but you can outwalk it. You literally only take it because you don't feel like walking, but you don't care about how when you get there.
Is it that slow?
It is that bad.
Well, it depends. I've been on it twice. Well, actually, 4 times if you count out and back. But one time, the guy was going so quick, I thought, man, get out of our way, people. We're heading up Woodward.
It's a mess. It's not done properly. Anyways.
Yeah.
Wine. More wine. We need more wine, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Wine 2.12 is now available.
I saw that.
Yes. Ooh. And for anyone who doesn't know, I would have, on the last episode, like a few days after we recorded, wine 2.12. 1.0 was available, now it's 2.2. Yes, 30 days later, they have another release update.
Holy cow.
So I guess they have a really fast release cycle, code sprinting. Yeah, 2.11 and 2.12. 2.11 was just very briefly
ago. How good
ago.
Is it? I haven't used wine.
No.
I haven't knowingly used wine in a long time.
That's the thing. Me either, because now I haven't, with the exception of Photoshop still, I have a native Linux alternative to everything. So I don't really use it anymore, but I still went through and read because it's a big deal to a lot of people. I guess there's a lot of things working now that they've been getting in there for, getting a lot of compatibility. And so there's probably... I see games in here more than else.
Okay.
Lost Horizons.
That tends to be the driver of it, I think.
Deus Ex.
Games and porn.
Deus Ex. It's a really cool game. I know because I run it on a Windows PC.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great, and apparently that game works fine now. So what else is there? My Life Organized works. There's a few little... Yeah, I don't know what that is.
My Life Organized is the name of a game?
I wonder if it is. There's some great names of games. Some of them are not safe to say on the podcast, but one of them is amusing. Is you have one where you try to stop a child from doing things, and it's kind of real life. Like the kid tries, it's a baby that goes and tries to get everything, and the goal is to not have the baby die, and it's a game.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's kind of close to real life because you're like, oh no, don't put that in your mouth. Nope, don't touch that.
Oh,
so, but they made a game
so
out of that.
So you're chasing the baby around, trying to get
the baby.
The goal is to keep
the baby alive.
Okay.
Wow.
But I'm like, that's too real.
Yeah, it's just like real life.
It is like real life. We spend a lot of time telling our children, don't do that, stop that.
I feel like that's been my life for the last 5 years.
Yeah, Tony's got 3 kids. I'm glad that mine are older, so they're going to do something big and dumb, but they'll at least not put something in their mouth. So they're just going to, like, Dad, I crashed the car.
Right.
That's coming up soon. Anyways, I hope that I never hear that.
I hope you don't either.
I know. They're going to break something big. I don't know. That's what they do when they get older. One of them drove through a fence already, so I drove through a fence. What? That's a whole other story. She wasn't paying attention, I think, and she just, no one was hurt. The car wasn't hurt, and it had cost her $500 to fix the fence. Wow. She
drove through the, I hit a deer shortly after I began driving.
Yeah, things like that happen. Anyways.
Oh, where you grew up. Yeah, there's deer everywhere.
Yeah, out in Jackson. Yeah, all over the place.
Bothan Spy. This is another dump from the WikiLeaks Vault 7. Yes. Mm. More specifically, it's a really interesting piece of CIA malware. Mm-hmm. And because we know the encryption on SSH keying is really good, so they realized don't attack it at the place you can't get through. So we know that if we have an encrypted SSH session, that the encryption is solid. They haven't figured out any easy cracks for it. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you set up listeners and on compromised machines that only listen for very quietly the SSH keys themselves. So what they do is the concept of the Bothan Spy is it's a malware that doesn't behave.
And that's Bothan, B-O-S-O-N?
B-O-T-H-A-N.
Okay.
And so what they're doing is they're attacking things at the source and going, if we can compromise their computer and we just listen for the keys, and that becomes a way for them to infiltrate. That way it doesn't raise any red flags. It's very small amount of data being listened to. Mm-hmm. So it's like we compromise the computer of our target and then we collect all of his keys quietly and then we use them elsewhere.
Okay.
So it's interesting, and I have a write-up on it. I'll leave the link in the show notes for there. This reminds me, though, this happened to someone who lost a bunch of Bitcoins. There is a piece of malware out there that's really, really unknown. And this guy found it. I wish I had a link to the article because it was in the Security Now podcast. If you go two episodes back, it was in the Security Now podcast by Steve Gitson. Really fascinating. The malware does one single thing.
Spend your money?
It takes your money.
Okay.
Bitcoin addresses are really long addresses. Yeah. So you generally copy and paste them out of your wallet. The only thing this spyware does exclusively is wait for you to copy a Bitcoin address in the wallet. And when you paste it, it pastes its own Bitcoin address. Mm-hmm. And because the numbers are so long, you're assuming you copied and pasted it. It switches the numbers to be their Bitcoin address. Oh. So your transaction ends up going to them. And it's a very clever spyware that can sit quietly. And because it's so unknown, a lot of things don't look for it. And it's just watching the clipboard. Mm-hmm. So this guy lost $30,000. He tried to pay for something with Bitcoin. And he said, I sent the transaction through. And after some research, he says, no, I somehow put in the wrong Bitcoin address. And after some more research.
And then it's gone.
Yeah. As soon as the money goes into that account, you can't transfer it back. They're not giving it back. Mm-hmm. And then it moves it around to other accounts. So it's a really interesting malware that's really, really hard to find.
And are those Bitcoin accounts insured by the FDIC?
They are not. Well, welcome
then
to
I am not using them.
Welcome to the flaw, so to speak, of cryptocurrency. Yeah. We love the idea that there is no bank centralized control.
Big ledgers, but.
But the scary part when you start putting this in hands of the public is we expect that. Like if someone robs your Bitcoin wallet, that's bad, but there's not. I mean, we know the crypto is really good. We know it's not a that you can't compromise the crypto. It's things like this little piece of spyware that run on there, so that it becomes very, very scary for the transactions. And there's no insurance. The guy lost $30,000. That's it.
Yeah.
That's done. He's out the money, which of course sent him on the search to what did it, and he found this little tool that probably got bundled with some software he installed or something. He doesn't know where it came from, so there wasn't a lot of follow up as to that. But they are aware of the program and are developing signatures to find it. So
when I heard about that, I was like, what would I do in that case? You know, because those numbers are so long.
Yeah,
but the only thing I think of is I would like read the first five characters and last five characters, make sure they match up.
Yeah.
You know, because for the place you're
sending. I thought about that too. There's not an easy method for that. I'm trying to think of what would stop that as a side channel. There's really nothing because you're dealing with your computer being compromised. And that's the one thing of Bitcoin is you can do a transaction between me and Tony without a third party. So there's no one to insure or offer any service in that. So definitely a problem. Now, this is really cool, and I was hoping Phil would be here for this. Let's Encrypt is doing wildcard certificates in 2018.
Really?
Yes. And what that's they're doing some rewrites, and they're going to be able to offer so you can wildcard a domain so your subdomains will work on there.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Use the same key against all of your subdomains.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and that seems very efficient.
It does, because one of the things that we have, even ourselves, we have multiple certificates for things. So we have a certificate for each, because we use a series of subdomains on our domain. Mm-hmm. That's how we hook up the different external services to our internal servers that land on different IP addresses, but then we have to get a Let's Encrypt certificate for each one.
Right.
So they don't have a wildcard option.
And the hardest part is if those internal servers aren't accessible from the internet, then you can't just use the updater app or program script to get the update the script.
This would actually help us in a couple ways where we have locked down internal apps that we have to use self-signed certificates. That there's a really hacky way to make them not self-signed, but now we can actually do it where we wildcard them and we can get rid of all those SSL errors because we have internal applications we develop that are completely not accessible to the internet, which doesn't allow us to use Let's Encrypt on there. But if we wildcard our domain, so we would have a domain we set up that even though it's only internally accessible, would not give us an SSL error every time we opened it up.
Yeah.
So kind of a neat concept there. This is worth a read. This is kind of funny. I like the comments from Linus. You know, love or hate the guy, he's definitely a luminary in the Linux world. But occasionally what he says is really amusing. So there's apparently a bug in the Cavnium CN55X to fix a broken config. And they suggested the people who developed this part of the kernel patch says you should just enable this by default. This is his reply to their asking that as a request. Every developer always thinks that their driver code is so special and magical it should be enabled by default. And most of them are completely and utterly wrong. That's definitely not the case when you write a specific driver for a very unusual security processor that it does not get to mark itself as default. If you solve world hunger, make a default driver that cures people of cancer, by all means, enable it by default. But as far as I know, Cavium CNX does neither. So that's...
Wow. And what is that thing?
I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's some type of, I'm assuming, trusted compute module. So it's some unusual security driver, and I think that should always be enabled by the kernel by default. That way, obviously, we install it, and their boards have that in there. But... apparently, it also causes issues, and if it's a rare driver that you don't find commonly on motherboards, why would I want to enable it immediately? It's not like it's on every motherboard.
Exactly.
You just should have a kernel primer that turns that on. Now, this is weird. I like System 76. I think they're a really cool company. But Pop, that's Pop with exclamation point. That's their new Linux OS that they're going to be shipping on their systems. They're developing their own distro.
Don't tell me. Is it Ubuntu-based?
Of course it is. So we're going to fork Ubuntu, and I don't know the why exactly. I guess they give some reasons that they want to do some more things and develop. And I don't know if this is a because you can.
Are there going to be any telemetry touch points involved with it?
Probably not.
Sending back system health reports or something like that.
Yeah. And in terms of whether or not they'll be following the Ubuntu release or sticking with the LTS stack, their reply was, we'll be rebasing to each release, but we plan to iterate quickly. Maybe they're being kind of vague, and the name's kind of awful, I think. I won't lie.
Pop?
It's Pop.
Who came up with that?
I don't know.
They didn't pay any money for that.
Yeah. Right. Their logo is just Pop, like with an exclamation point and funny letters. That's like they have a logo for it, and it's Pop, and it's got an underscore OS. So Pop exclamation point. I don't know. It's on their website. Beautiful. This is their own buzzwords. Beautiful, modern, powerful. Pop OS designed to people who use their computer to create, whether it's complicated professional grade software or products built on Ubuntu. Oh, I like it. It says get it poppin' at System 76. I mean, they're really. I think it's all about buzzwords. I'm sorry. That's how I feel about it right now.
Yeah, I think
I don't know.
It
comes to the famous question: because you can doesn't mean you should all the time. I mean, I'm all for we fork things and do things like that. But I guess where's the value?
Are you sure it's a full OS or because when I was looking just now, I saw Pop themes.
Nope. Go to System76/Pop. It's a full OS. It's a full fork, but different.
I'm wondering if it's really setting up another revenue stream for them in some fashion. Maybe there'll be some additional.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Tony's seeing buzzword bingo over there. He's like, "Do we have we touched point on all the buzzwords yet?"
Well, here's my question:
Beautiful, modern, powerful.
See.
Okay, what about Fresh? Is that there?
Maybe you put Fresh in there.
Hey, but are they going to be using the same? And I'm sorry, because I'm computerless. Well, I have a phone computer, but are they using the same Ubuntu desktop?
It sounds like they're tweaking it.
Okay.
So,
it's
because I think
GNOME
is what they're going back to. Oh, there it is.
Well, Ubuntu's going back to GNOME, so that is the default desktop now. So so in a way, you're right.
I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's bright colors and
it's
the background is like
that. Blue looks like Windows 10 blue.
The colors really pop on it.
No. Oh my god!
Now this is for those of us and like me and Tony who. You know, really our jobs are sysadmin work where we worked in mixed environments, specifically a lot of Windows environments. This is something, and I linked to the discussion on Reddit about this because this has been annoying me greatly.
Okay.
And in increasing degree. So the latest iteration of Windows 10, they just keep making things harder. And I count clicks a lot. And they, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're a sysadmin, it means a lot.
Sure.
One of the things we're seeing in Windows is they've made it harder after the latest version of Windows 10 to get to things. Like Update Manager. Used to, you could go to the little search thing and type update. It doesn't come up anymore. You have to get more specific and type Windows Update. And it used to come up, but now it's not coming up. They've literally buried things to be more clicks. They also took away some of the right-click context menus that were you could right-click on system to get places.
Really?
Decided that wasn't necessary. So now what used to take me 3 clicks takes me 6. Mm. And those...
Can you script it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. I'm going to have to find a bash script that helps me open up dialog boxes in Windows.
Hey, you know, they got the Ubuntu on Windows now.
Yeah, so. But I don't understand it. It's like I understand hiding things.
If you can find what the name of CPL is, then you can just launch that from the search bar.
I do that a lot, but now that they're trying to eliminate the control panel, I think that we're not long for being – I've always run that because I love it. You know, you hit Windows key R, and I just run whatever the name is, .cpl, and I have them all. I have a lot of them memorized. You know, appwiz.cpl because I'm going to remove whatever dumb thing you just installed. That's like – but how long is that for this world at the rate they're going? I understand hiding things from there, but I almost wish it was like a shortcut key.
I think – wow. They're just going to – what they're just simply going to do is, you know, because everything's moving to the cloud, they're just going to slowly take away – you won't own that control panel.
It just boots and goes to a browser.
Yeah, they'll just – yeah.
They really should be like a technician mode.
They have a developer mode.
It's called I Run Linux on my computer.
that too. But they do have a developer mode. I activated it because that was – why now when I – that laptop I got – now when I start it up, there's this big banner, there's a bright red banner across the top with an open lock that tells me that I've unlocked. Yeah, because I unlocked Secure Boot and I haven't gone any much further.
I know, but what I'm talking about, like technician mode, is say that you have your home user brings their computer in and needs it worked on. Mm-hmm. Well, they can hide all the icons from that person. But when they bring it in here, you know,
somewhere
for a tech to work on it. The tech just
take the cover
puts
off
in a certain command or something, and it brings up all the
I can't wait to just details. We can get the consumers running Linux and our life. It's really weird. I mean, Linux has become more and more customizable. They've made it easier for people to use, but at the same time, made it people like me and Tony want to do something more advanced in a sysadmin side very easy to do still Linux. So we haven't lost that. So I don't think Microsoft's making the right compromises there, and they're making administration more and more difficult, which is just super annoying.
Hey, but their Azure revenue has gone through the roof.
Yeah.
No. Oh, good for them.
Good for them.
You're in a bad mood today, Tony.
I've been awake for about an hour right
now. All right, yeah.
No, he didn't come in with coffee either, did he? So
he's got his snark on.
Yeah. So, on to the next. China shut down VPNs.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, they're blocking more and more VPNs because they realize the great firewall of China that uses DNS to block, people go, well, there's a VPN out of there. But what does that mean for other companies that VPN is just part of the service offering or the way they do things? Like Google offers an auto VPN on my phone and things like that. Will they be blocking that? Mm-hmm. Also, generally speaking, most companies VPN their traffic between sites all the time.
Sure.
So what level are they going to do? They really want to block all the VPNs, and where does that lead?
VPNs that lead out of the country or something.
Yeah. Well, maybe, then again, how do you, any U.S. companies are going to have VPNs back to the
U.S.?
Yeah,
that's true.
And how do you distinguish between them? So,
well, they'll probably have to submit paperwork or something that says, hey, this is a company VPN.
Yeah. And they've talked about that too, to have things monitored, but then China may want a backdoor to it. So it's kind of interesting that they're trying to lock down the internet in China. Mm-hmm. at the same time, Alibaba was just here, the big Chinese
Jack
company.
Jack Ma
was here speaking over at, and he was talking about the openness that they want to bring because there's a massive demand for American products. And they want to get our products over there. So while you're blocking all kinds of things, at the same time, you're like, please sell us product from America. We want to import your products. So I'm not sure. If you can't search and find American products, I don't really, Back to a next concern. Panda Security has a advisory on CHRYSAR, Chrysler. Anyways, it's a very unknown, until more recently, it's been around, I think they said for 4 years, a really scary malware that goes on Android. And this is one of the reasons I've always been so worried about some of the Android.
It goes on Android.
Yes.
Okay, that's very...
It can come through on a text message. It spreads through a smartphone. Okay. It's very hard to detect. It self-destructs.
Is it a link in a text message that wants you to click on it, which I never do?
Yeah, which you never do. So it does have that as an attack, but they've also leveraged it different takes. But it's a very secretive malware that self-destructs upon examination.
Oh, really?
And because of that, it's been very elusive, and they think it's been around, I think they said, for 4 years.
But no one knows for sure.
That's part of the problem. No one knows wrong. And it'll slowly send information back from your phone in a quiet manner with some side channels. So it's kind of a scary little piece of malware. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things like there's been some real security flaws that have been pointed out that Google themselves has denied as a flaw and said as a feature. And one of them is the fact that in Android, applications are allowed to be on top of other applications. And that's how Facebook chat heads work.
Oh, okay.
And the problem with that is you can actually transpose on top. Let's say you're using an application like LastPass to ask you your password. Mm-hmm. They can put something on top of LastPass that looks like LastPass to ask you to know your password.
Oh.
That's why I want one LastPass on my phone. That is a feature. All it takes is an app. And there's a proof of concept that the security researchers did that's been in the store for over a year that they didn't do anything malicious, but they proved that they can put on top of other apps, make it look like you're typing in. They can make it look like you're typing into a website that you're not because it allows it to go over the top of. And they said that shouldn't – iPhone doesn't allow this.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be only enabled in special use cases by a vetted company, and it's not vetted. You can simply turn it on.
They call it feature draw on top or something like that, right?
Yep, it's a draw on top.
Yeah, and that's how you get like the hover over kind of windows or apps, applets, like in Android. And like you're saying, just how LastPass works is to be able to bring it up and say, I want this, now put it into the web page.
Mm-hmm.
Or Facebook Messenger, you're saying that's how it hovers like above the app that's in the background.
Yeah.
That's actually really annoying to me.
Yes.
I wish you could find a non-hover on top version of these things.
Yeah, it's... Definitely annoying.
But that is a I heard that they're supposed to be fixing that in the next release or did they say they're not going to release it? They said, oh, that's just how it works.
Android
said that. I thought they said they're not going to stop it from working, but they're going to make it a permission you could turn on and off.
I'm not super clear on it because they haven't done it. So.
Yeah.
And, of course, it won't happen all the older Android versions, and that's scary.
Right.
The last little piece of my news is $4.5 million worth of Jeeps were stolen by Mexican bikers, and how that has to do with
Jeeps?
Yes. So
how'd they wrangle that?
They wrangled quite a few Jeeps. Nice. So they stole a bunch of Jeeps with hacked keys. And they've apparently been doing this for years. Jeeps have been disappearing. And the problem is there's no security on these. And this maybe is the next IoT thing that needs to be done, where you have some type of secondary security, because clearly we cannot rely on the automotive companies to keep us secure.
No.
I don't know if this is the same story, but I caught part of the story before then. I thought it was where it was physical keys. That they hacked into the dealer's software, and they got like the VIN number and the key out, pin out or whatever.
They stole the software that produces it. that yeah. produces the key fobs. And because they are all key fob now, it's not even a key you need. It's the key fob to unlock the door. So they made a key fob programmer, and they had the algorithm that they used, which why were they using an algorithm to do this, that you can type in the VIN number and it creates a key fob. So they would pick the Jeep, they would target them and grab the key, just grab the number on it. And yeah, I'm like, really, guys? Really? This is how your system works? This seems like a horrible idea because somehow someone got a copy of the software, and now these guys have a copy of the software. So who knows who else has a copy of the software is the scary part. So now they can just take the software, they type it in, and it produces a key fob on the fly and unlocks the car. Mm-hmm. You just drive away with it. There's no braking or anything. You
I was going to say, so there's entering, but no braking.
Yeah, there's entering but no braking. And it was only by some chance of someone getting caught, and I think they read the text message because they didn't understand how they were stealing it, and they someone had some surveillance footage, and they just watched this guy walk right up and get in the Jeep and leave. Mm. And they're like, look, we didn't know this guy. We didn't give him our keys. We still have our key fobs. And that's what led them to the stolen dealership software. Mm. So yeah, so that's kind of scary. I think that may be an opportunity, and also security through obscurity doesn't work. They thought they had obscured the, oh, we'll just lock down this. And, you know, it's, yeah, that's.
yeah.
Always. So what do you got, Tony?
Well, a few things. I haven't been following the drone thing with the FAA recently.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently in May, they strike down the rule that you have to register your drone.
They did.
So you no longer have to do that.
I already did, though.
yeah. Well, they said you can get your $5 back.
Sweet.
So I have a there's a link in I have a TechCrunch article that explains that the FAA has created a or is doing refunds now for the $5 you paid to register drones, and there's a link in the article.
Is this part of the if you make a new regulation, you got to get rid of two regulations? Is that the new administration's?
I don't know.
I'm wondering because I can kind of see both sides of that. I think it makes sense. Some drones are pretty powerful, and if they're interfering enough, and I saw this, I think there was a news item about this wildfires out west. It prevented some firefighting activity from aircraft fighting fires because some drones were up there. Mm. I think some houses were adversely impacted, meaning that they either burnt down or had some fire damage because of that. So I see.
Wow.
I see a lot of. I can see lawsuits coming out of that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I also see, hey, you know, so much government regulation. You got this little drone, and you know, it's sort of like, well, I'm going to regulate kites next.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I wonder, you've heard of those drone killers? You know, it's like an EMP. No, it's an EMP gun.
I thought that was that a hoax, or was that real?
I thought it was real.
Well, it's an EMP.
Prototype or whatever. Well, I wonder if there's a way.
Mary, tap your mic real quick. Her mic went dead.
Uh-oh.
Did you touch something on it?
No. I didn't touch anything.
Oh, it's working now.
Okay.
Okay. It cut out somewhere. I just noticed. I looked. I'm like, Mary wasn't talking.
Oh. Uh-oh. Okay.
All right, you're good now.
All right, great. Should I start over? No, just kidding. So what was the your comment?
You're talking about
I was talking about the drone.
The
pros and cons of the firefighter drones. They the drones that were aloft when firefighting efforts were underway out west, and the interference that those drones presented to the efforts of some of the aircraft who were dropping that fire retardant.
Makes me wonder if there's a way to hook up one of those drone killers, you know, the EMP guns.
Well, that's...
The problem with EMP is it requires so much voltage to get it to work.
Yeah, it's so hard to get that on a plane.
It's hard to get that on there, so it's really, really difficult to stop the drones. That's and here's the other problem. There's the concept of, well, we'll just jam the frequency. No problem. My drone flies back home when you jam the frequency. It goes up, I lost signal, it just shows back up at my house. It shows back up wherever it took off from.
Oh, really? Hmm.
That's part of it. Whenever I launch it, the first one, and you can turn it off, but I always leave it on by default. Whenever I launch my drone, it sets the GPS and it says home point updated. It actually says it verbally, and then it launches. And what that is if the controller goes bad or anything happens with the communications, it automatically has a return home protocol. And you set how many minutes. If it loses 5 minutes of communication, it shoots back and goes, okay, I'm coming back where I took off from.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Well, that's a good thing. And then people could follow it, or the police could follow it or something.
Yeah. Which is why some may turn it off.
Exactly.
Right.
So.
All right. So the next article I found is Google launches the go-to job aggregation website. So
go-to job?
Go-to. The go-to. Like the best job aggregation website. And it says it's a website, but it's just another Google. A Google search.
Just another Google.
if you type in, like in Google search, type in job search, then Google job search comes up, and you can, there's all sorts of customizations. You can search by category, tile.
So is this kind title, of a meta search, Tony, city. Then, where you can, it will go out to various job sites like Monster, Career Builder, not LinkedIn exactly, but, and then pull that and aggregate it for you?
Yep.
It's like kind of like Trivago for right hotels. Now.
It says it found it in Glassdoor, Indeed, and Kurunu. I have no clue what that is. You know, there's an account manager.
Oh, okay.
And that one's in those three also. They said they've tested it against Xerox and what's the other ones? I was looking at the webpage and I need to get Johnson & Johnson, Career Builder, and HealthSouth. There's an API. It goes through and scrubs all those different job search websites. And so you can go through and you can set it to send you alerts whenever something comes up. And
you know, speaking of getting alerts from Google, I get them every day. No, seriously, I had taken a look at some airfares to Las Vegas because I'm going out there in a couple weeks. And I ended up using some frequent flyer miles. But before I went that route, the cost to go out to Las Vegas from Detroit was like 400 and some bucks. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And that's what led me then to, I had some miles sitting around. I used them. But I set it up for Google to alert me when the price changes. And the price has dropped now. It's like $390. And I think it either dropped or some other change to it. And I got another alert from Google. So it's kind of interesting to watch that. And if you're somebody who doesn't mind leaving at the last minute, sometimes you can get these last minute deals where you got to be ready to go at the drop of a hat. Hey, right. You weren't here when I made my little announcement that I'm going to Iceland in September.
Oh, so well, you go every other year, don't you, or something?
Twice a year.
Twice a year.
Hey, it was so cheap, you guys. I forgot to mention, out of Boston, going a round trip to Reykjavik was 420 bucks. Yeah,
that's awesome.
420 out of Boston. That's nothing.
Yeah.
So,
back to that last article, I tried jobs.google.com.
Yeah.
And it redirects you to careers.google.com.
Okay.
And I think that's if you want to work at Google.
Yeah, so, that one's for at Google.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that's not the job search. So if you, I don't know, I just typed search jobs within the Google search and it brought it up. And it looks different. You can tell that it's a job search thing, not a regular internet search. I found the same article that Tom was talking about, the CIA stealing your SSH creds with the Both and Spy tool. So that was an interesting article. But I found one more app or malware for Android from securityweek.com. They talk about, it's called the Spy Dealer malware steals private data from popular Android apps. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah.
A recent discovery of the Android Trojan can exfiltrate private data from more than 40 applications, says the Palo Alto security researchers. And it goes through and it's able to grab, because it sits on your phone, everything's decrypted at that point. So it doesn't matter if you're using an encrypted software or encrypted channels of communications.
I think that's a strategy. They know the encryption's solid. You can't get by the encryption, so now we're just going to jump at the point before it's encrypted.
Exactly. So you have to infect the endpoint of where it's open. You know, things like WhatsApp, Facebook chat, WeChat, Viber, Tango, the list keeps on going. You got to watch out. It says it can remotely control the victim's device. Malware implements in three different CNC, or command and control channels, and supports more than 50 commands. I didn't see where they think that the initial infection happens. But I'm sure it's an app that you accidentally install.
That's usually what happens.
They said one exposure, the gain replivage is below. It's from one of the Easy Root apps, is one way that they found the Baidu. B-A-I-D-U. Baidu.
Okay. Baidu.
Baidu.
Yeah, that's Chinese Google.
Oh. Well, yeah, so if you want to root your phone and use that app, most likely you've just gotten
owned
malware.
That's also one of the reasons I don't root my phone.
Yeah. So be careful. Yeah, know what software you're downloading and installing on your stuff. Because really, when you get in that kind of activities where you're trying to root your phone, you're getting into things where you're turning off all the security that's built into Android and whatever phone manufacturer you're using.
So whose fault is that then?
Right. It's yours. Yeah, it's your own. Right.
So, okay.
So, yeah. And that's all that I found.
All right. So I got a couple KD corners. Oh, cool. Tom, I think you saw that Kden Live, I think they're coming out with a new release. So I'm not going to spend much time talking about that other than the fact that anybody who likes Kden Live will appreciate it. I think I did tell you my story that I crashed on me. I ended up using OpenShot for some of my Icelandic stuff, some of the stuff I was putting together for my last trip. Light rail trip downtown, and my clips were like over a gig because I was pausing the camera at stops and not stopping it, which I don't think it liked the 1 gig clips.
Mm.
So I drop a couple of those in there and attempt to do something with them. It didn't like it. So
yeah.
Anyway, but the other thing I'm going to say is that there's a site called UbuntuBuzz.com, and I had not heard of it, but this past Friday, actually a couple days ago, they had 6 interesting things on KDE Plasma 5.10.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I haven't had a chance to try these all out, but one of them that I've tried out is if you've got something in the clipboard, you can take the and you're on the panel, the task panel at the bottom, you can use the middle click button and it will automatically take your clipboard contents and stick it in a note for you. So I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
You can also end up automatically grouping things. So if you've got I think I've got that already activated because if I've got three writer documents from, LibreOffice Writer open, it groups them together, and then I just click the icon, and then it gives me kind of a dashboard-like view, and I can click on the one I want to work on. So so there's that. Also, changing to folder quick access panel, you right-click on Dolphin. It's going to give you a little list of folders. You can go in from there.
Mm.
Some really cool stuff. So that was...
I learned something else you can do in Dolphin. And when you do a new folder, if I typed in Tom and I put a slash and I say subfolder and another slash, it creates all the subfolders when you do the new folder if you add the slashes.
Yeah.
Dolphin is so cool.
Dolphin. Huh. Oh, my gosh.
That is cool.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so there's that. And that's about that's all I got from KDE Corner.
All right.
I guess we've
moved on. And I think we actually, because we didn't do music last time. So we went into music this time.
We picked music.
We did. Ooh.
So
yeah.
We're going to roll
Tony,
that.
Tony, you'd be proud of us. Normally that's your job, but you went ahead and did it.
The outgoing music for this week's show.
All right. It is Tux in the Fog.
the 70s.
Wawa pedal?
Wawa. Yeah. Yeah, the Wawa stuff. You know, on a quick musical note, so Linus from Linus Media Group, who has a YouTube channel, Linus Tech Tips, he did a walkthrough with Deadmau5, the techno music producer of his house.
Yeah, the guy with the big...
Really? The most amazing studio probably in the world I've ever seen. It happens to be built inside of his house. And they spent like untold millions on it. Just the mixer board was over $1 million. He's also one of the only places outside of Dolby Studios that has a Dolby mixer in there. It's a black box that they're not allowed to talk about other than it hooks up in there. It's part of the way the Dolby mixing system. He was allowed to have one, but he's not allowed to take it apart. And they also have all these old analog things. And apparently, I didn't know this, Deadmau5, the producer, is actually a collector of all kinds of interesting musical instruments, and he's built an entire wall of analog instruments, not for show, but for use. They all can connect to his mixer board, and he does it. Wow. He goes, it's not like he wants to produce it. It's all about inspiration, and they demo in the video of how you go through and how he turns on these, you know, 20-year-old mixers and plugs them into the mixer board just so we can get a sound, and it kind of creates like this environment. He also has R2-D2, and what I mean by that is the machine that made the R2-D2 noises.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he has that.
That's cool.
And I guess he was helpful in the production of Netflix Stranger Things because they wanted that 80s feel, and those instruments they use in the 80s don't exist anymore. He happens to have them. He bought these old mixer boards that no one wanted. Now they're actually very available.
Is this a Netflix show?
No, it's a YouTube video, and they went behind the scenes. Stranger Things is a Netflix.
That's what I meant. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, pretty cool. Just a side note about that. It was really fascinating because it's all this old, some weird eclectic stuff, but it's also in a new multi-million dollar, they refer to them as suspended studios. So the whole, it's inside of a building and they suspend it to isolate it from the outside world. So the studio has absolutely non-disrupted sound reproduction. So
wow.
It's just cool to see if you're into audio at all. So
yeah, that is cool.
So I guess that wraps things up. That it does. Started as just the two of us. Now it's just three of us.
Yeah. So you've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This has been episode 241, just the two of us plus one now.
Yeah.
This is Mary Tomich.
Tom Lawrence.
And Tony Bemis.
See you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.